On RN, What Keeps Me Awake, with Kim Williams.
I'm Kim Williams. Welcome to What Keeps Me Awake. My guest today is not a relative, but his name is very similar. It's Kip Williams. At the age of just 30, Kip already has an impressive list of achievements in the Australian performing arts. He was recently appointed as the Artistic Director of the Sydney Theatre Company. The reason I asked Kip to join me on the program is that I think he is, as a director and theatre thinker, one of the most compelling talents to have arisen in the last two decades on the Australian stage. But what keeps Kip Williams awake?
Goodness, sometimes it might be easy to answer by talking about what doesn't keep me awake. A lot keeps me awake. Certainly the current international political climate keeps me awake. Obviously Trump has had a big impact on a number of ways in which we think about the world. I grow increasingly concerned about the state of global affairs and the potential of nuclear warfare and the sort of ideas that I thought we'd left behind in the 20th century.
Well, of course, you've just directed a play that deals with many of these issues in a really challenging fashion. And I'm referring to Chimerica, which deals with the Tiananmen uprising and the events in Beijing in 1989. What drove you in the course of that, given that the events are so very real and so forcefully impressed on one's mind?
Well, particularly with this play, which was written in 2013, but really felt like it had been written on the day. Every day we went to rehearsals, it felt like the play became more and more resonant. And the play explores the relationship between China and America, and it's fascinating in that it's written by a British playwright because it has a sense of an outsider's perspective on that relationship. And for myself as an Australian director working with an Australian team on the show, there was an even extra element of removal to be able to look at that relationship, how it's evolved since 1989, and where it stands today. I couldn't be more concerned about that relationship between China and America. I think the hope that came for me from Lucy's play was the ability for an individual to be able to stand up in the face of certain actions, morally dubious actions carried out by governments and to oppose them and to speak out against them. And we all have the potential to speak out.
It's this challenge to a single individual to act. Rather than to actually let things pass by.
Yes, and we're living in a time where protest seems to have returned to the centre of political life, which I'm sort of thrilled by, and that is some kind of soothing glass of metaphorical milk at evening when I'm trying to sleep to think of the way in which we're becoming more politically activated. And, you know, it's interesting to think about the ways in which the individual can speak out today, the ways in which we're empowered to speak out. You can certainly argue that certain forms of social media can allow us to speak out in a way that is more immediate than, say, what Tank Man had to do and stand in front of a line of tanks. But at the same time, the way in which those platforms are limited in their ability to give us access to complex arguments. And it's really the absence of complex engagement with the problems that we're faced today.
This is an abiding concern of yours, isn't it? The degeneration of language.
Mm. Well, I work with language every day and work with some of the finest minds in the country, writers, designers, actors, in unpicking language and trying to understand the way that it operates. And when I come home and watch the news or pick up a newspaper or click on a news website to read about what's happening in the world, I'm constantly met with the way in which language is being used by politicians to to spread falsehoods rather than elucidating truth, and to simplify complex problems in a way which leads people into a false sense of those realities rather than opening up the complexity of those ideas. And Trump, for me, stands front and center as a politician who does this. I mean, I watched his election very closely, all the way from the pre-selection of the Republican candidate through to his ultimate victory, as disappointing as
that was. His surprise win on the night.
His surprise bolt from nowhere. And his use of language, I was actually quite in awe of, appalled by, but in awe of. The way that he was able to discredit and dismantle his opposition through what seems like quite juvenile schoolyard tactics in demeaning his opposition with language, I found fascinating. So constantly referring to Ted Cruz as Lion Ted, or Mark Rubio as Little Mark Rubio, the way that he used language around Hillary Clinton to crooked Hillary, to demean his opponents and smear them with ideas, as false as they may have been, that invariably stick for most people.
But I imagine, as the artistic director of the Sydney Theatre Company, all of this territory is rich with opportunity in terms of giving theatre that kind of electric relevance.
Oh, that's right. I mean, it's been fascinating that we've had a number of productions of Richard III on our stages this year across Australia, all of which have taken on new resonance for audiences. I can't reveal too much about what my 2018 season is going to be, but it's certainly informed by the current political climate and the way in which language is used as a weapon to spread falsehood and to intentionally simplify ideas in order to prevent people from engaging with complex truths. And I think that that's part of the responsibility of somebody who runs a company like Sydney Theatre Company, to use the art form to draw attention to these problems.
One of the things that you said is that you want to use the opportunity at the Sydney Theatre Company to give people permission to speak.
Mm.
What did you mean?
Well, I'm firmly of the opinion that any act of storytelling is a political act. So even if you look at See Spot Run, there is a latent politics inside that story. You can look at the way that Spot's mother and father are depicted differently in the different roles that they hold, and there is a kind of latent gender politics inside See Spot Run. And obviously, when you're engaging with more complex stories, the kind of political resonance within them amplifies. And so ultimately, I'm firmly of the belief that any storyteller has to deal with the politics of their work responsibly, and that there's a great privilege in being a storyteller, because you, particularly in the theatre, which is a communal act, you're asking people to renegotiate their sense of their society collectively with other people from their society. And part of my job as an artistic director is to get to choose who gets to engage in that act, who gets to speak, as I put it. And I think that's an exciting thing too. I think hearing new perspectives is part of the reason why we turn to art, to imagine the world from the perspective of somebody who's not us, and to find those things that resonate similarly between us and that perspective, and to learn from the newness of those perspectives.
So in approaching the work of Carol Churchill, which you're about to do your second major production of a Churchill play in Cloud Nine that's coming up, what kind of inner demons trouble you?
Carol's writing definitely keeps me awake at night because it is so complex. Churchill writes in a way which I actually find truer to life, where her characters want more than one thing at any one point in time. But I think the other thing that draws me to her writing that often will unlock demons within me and anxieties within me, but also ignite a passion within me and a drive within me, is that her plays ask questions at the core of the way that we see ourselves.
She is that unusual thing, a woman playwright.
Mm.
And as I understand it, women playwrights are performed very much less than men playwrights in Australia. Is that something that you see as being a core kind of mission over the coming years?
Absolutely. I think think it's a problem. I think it's a big problem, and one that across the board in Australia we need to do better with. And we have centuries of plays that are written predominantly by men, often simply for men, and containing politics that reflect the time in which they were composed of, more often than not, problematic gender politics. And there's a lot that can be done to redress that, but it creates a challenge for a theatre company when you're specifically aspiring to parity with the number of female and male writers that you're producing, and yet your canon is so weighted in the direction of male writers. And that just is a really exciting thing when it comes to the new work that you're exploring and the creating of new classics through new Australian writing. And we're blessed in Australia with a plethora of female playwrights who continually produce extraordinary work. So that's the kind of upside of the mission of creating a greater parity on our stages.
On RN, What Keeps Me Awake with Kim Williams. Our guest is the Artistic Director of the Sydney Theatre Company, Kip Williams.
In the course of your career and all of the myriad things that you've done, what has kept you going in terms of mentorship and others that have been able to make you feel confident and secure in the creative pathway that you're pursuing?
I've been incredibly lucky in having a number of mentors who've been deeply generous towards me, and it's made it plainly apparent to me as an artistic director, as a new artistic director, albeit a relatively young one, how important it is to continue that tradition. Obviously, Andrew Upton was a huge supporter of mine and created great opportunity for me to push my boundaries and explore and really hone my craft. But then I also think of people like Jim Sharman, who has been so extraordinary towards me, and I meet with Jim every couple of weeks. Here's the example of an artist who inspires me because he really owns the fact that he's Australian. He doesn't try and hide that in any way whatsoever. And he was, you know, very early on in his career, acclaimed internationally and had this huge simultaneously commercial and artistic career ahead of him, both in theatre and music theatre and opera and film. And he specifically chose to come back to Australia and to work at the Lighthouse Theatre in Adelaide. And the reverberations from that decision in terms of the artists who've flown out of that company and the subsequent artists who he's mentored and developed.
But your influences go back even further, don't they? Because you were the beneficiary of a really terrific school teacher who happened to be a very talented sculptor and who I think has had an indelible impact on your life.
Yeah, she has. Yeah, so Bronwyn Oliver was my art teacher when I was aged 5 through to 8. And every lesson began with a blank piece of paper, and we had to, for the first 15 minutes, just draw anything we wanted. And then from there, the types of projects that she would get us to work on were always about breaking our preconceived ideas of what we thought something was. So she would come in and ask us to create an animal, but that animal had to have a minimum of 3 heads and over 6 limbs. And you know, in that sense, she instilled in me at a very young age a sense in which the creative process was about pushing your own conception of what you thought something was. Yeah, certainly a lot of paint and clay on the walls in that art class. But she was such a very warm and nurturing influence and created a very safe space to create in.
Did she give you a hunger to be working in the creative community?
Absolutely. I mean, her whole philosophy was about pushing yourself to invent a new way of seeing the world. And I think when you're 5 or 6 and you're only beginning to see what the world is, to have somebody say to you, yeah, but think differently about it, is something that never leaves you. The older I get, the more fortunate I realise I was to have her and a number of other teachers through the years, but particularly Bronwyn.
So transposing then to now, how do you feel education's travelling generally in Australia in liberating the same kind of energy and quest?
I mean, you hear a lot about STEM and you don't hear enough about STEAM in Australia, and I don't think there's nearly enough emphasis on the arts in Australia and the way in which the arts can be an incredibly powerful tool to apply to all other areas of academic pursuit. I mean, I adore mathematics and studied mathematics at the highest level in my final year of secondary education. But the thing that I loved most about it was problem solving. And that for me grew out of my love for creativity, thinking differently, being set a challenge and being able to crack a different way of thinking about it. And I really worry about the way in which the arts in education is thought of as being a hobby. And in that sense, it sort of segues into my thinking on the funding of education in general. I mean, I think there's such a way to go in terms of the way that we fund public education. I was the beneficiary of a scholarship that gave me a private education in my secondary education. And I would not have developed in the way that I did as a theatre practitioner if I hadn't been at a school where my drama teacher gave me the keys to the school hall and said, go and make theatre with your classmates after school every day. And that the kind of resources that were afforded at that particular school in order for me to play and experiment and explore and for my passion for the arts to be validated through a resourcing was extraordinary. And, you know, I really worry about particularly working in the arts where increasingly you're seeing applicants for drama schools come specifically from private education because those students have been resourced to develop that aspect of their academic pursuit. And I think that's a real problem, particularly when we come back to this idea of who's speaking and who's telling the stories and the great need for us to have a diversity of perspectives.
Well, of course, you're speaking in a very privileged space and in being a young person who's being given one of the most senior positions in the country and charged with the obligation to lead.
Mm.
Does that weigh upon you? I mean, inevitably, predictably, boringly, most articles about you will always start with your age. How do you push it aside and not let it constrain you?
Well, I tried to hide my age for a long time.
That's why you grew a beard.
It's why I kept my beard, and my mother hates my beard, and I've sort of doggedly persisted with it for two reasons. One, because it's sort of time efficient, and you don't have to shave in the morning, and second, because it aged me up. I mean, as you pointed out in the opening, I was 25 when I was directing Jack in Under Milkwood at STC. And working with a cast who, all of whom could have been my parents. And they knew visually, I mean, the beard only takes you so far. They knew that I was young. And I had rapidly gone from high school and university and then drama school into a professional sphere where the experience of leading had never been foreign to me, but I'd always led my peers. I'd never had to lead people who were older than me. And it was really tough. It was really tough. And I was very lucky in that first experience because Jack was so generous in very publicly saying, I trust Kip. I'm going to put myself in Kip's hands.
He's the director. He's in charge.
He was remarkable.
And yet you still had a moment of acute anxiety on the first night, I remember.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I thought my career was over. And I've matured a lot. I think when this question of leadership comes, you know, having a calm head and having perspective is so important. Having the knowledge that you do come through difficulties, that there is another side, that you come through to the other side of difficulty is something that when I was doing Under Milkwood, I didn't know. And I was so critical of my own work that I thought that I'd mucked it up. But I now know not to punish myself in that way. And that actually I'm more effective team member and leader when I'm not being so punitive, self-punitive.
I've always thought Australia doesn't do young or old very well and that Australians are in dismissive of those who are young or those who are really quite old, when in fact we should be drawing from the energy and life force on both sides to improve our settings as a nation.
I agree with you, particularly in terms of the way in which we don't value our elders. And the wisdom that we can garner from them, and not only just the wisdom that can come from them, but actually the vitality and productivity that can come from our elders. I think we're particularly in an art form like theatre, you know, where which can be so fashion-led, we're very quick to throw people onto the heap and hear no more from them.
Although Australia's probably quite good in comparison with some other places where we still have a good number of 70-year-olds that are actively performing.
Well, yeah, we do. I mean, when it comes to our actors, yeah, we have some of the best senior actors in the world.
Direction's another business.
Direction and playwriting and design, is different. And when it comes to young people, I think a lot of it is tall poppy syndrome. I think we have a real issue with high achievers in this country. We set people up and hold them up on a pedestal and then love to push them off and watch them fail. And it entirely reflects a cultural insecurity. And it's something that I hope will start to change. And I think the only way that it can change is through individual acts of generosity, like Jim Sharman's towards me, who is nothing but thrilled when a production of mine goes well and allows me to feel good about the job that I do. But I think that cultural predisposition to chopping down high achievers is a big part of the reason why we have an issue with young people.
It's a very irksome part of Australian life and really at times quite brutal.
Mm. Where does it come from, do you think?
Well, I think it goes back to where I'm doing the interview, but I think it goes back to the education thing that you were talking about, where we treat arts and thought as being sidebar events as opposed to process skills.
Mm.
We're a pretty small and relatively insignificant nation when you stand back and think about it, unless we resource our people to be exceptional.
Yes. We don't seem to have an issue with them being exceptional at sport.
Well, I personally would love to be able to draw from sport as an exemplar where people aspire to excellence at all times. So it's a terrific thing.
Mm. I suppose Ian Thorpe's an interesting example, though, of a sports person who then didn't fall into our idea of who a sports person should be, and then he again suffered the kind of perilous downfall of tall poppy syndrome.
Well, that's true. So let's leap forward 5 or 6 years. What would you like to look back on in terms of what has it been achieved in that period of time? And I'm not suggesting that you're in the job for only 5 or 6 years, I hasten to add, but what would you like to look back on as sort of the foundations?
Well, I think one of the major ways that my time in the company will be assessed by myself and by other people will be on the new Australian works that have been developed inside the company during my time. And I have a particular passion for and interest in producing works that explore Australian history. I look at the way in which, and if we're talking about cultural confidence, I look at the way in which other cultures both celebrate and interrogate their history through narrative. And I think that Australia pales in comparison to the way that other nations around the world are able to achieve such a culturally important act. So I think that's a big way in which I'll be looking back on my time inside STC. And then I think too, I mean, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, Kim, and
I think that worked out.
I'll hope that all the shows that I've done have landed and resonated. I mean, I don't detest entertainment in theatre. I think entertaining is incredibly important. I think meditatively having a space to escape and switch off is really important. But I want the works of entertainment that are produced during my time at STC to be rip-roaring, extraordinary, hilarious nights in the theatre that fill you with joy. And the rest of the material, which will likely be the majority of the material that's produced by STC during my time, needs to take responsibility for the political and moral and social consciousness of, to some extent, Australia. And I'm wanting the artists that I work with and the art that I make myself personally to ask important questions of our audience and to hopefully start to shift the dialogue around certain aspects of contemporary cultural life in Australia. So it's a big pursuit, but I think it's the pursuit of being an artist and particularly being an artistic director.
Well, I, with an army of others, very much look forward to taking that journey with you.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you very much for joining us on What Keeps Me Awake.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to What Keeps Me Awake. For more, head to the RN homepage.